Habitat loss, feral animals, and the worsening impacts of climate change are all daunting prospects for Australia's conservationists. But Atticus Fleming is fighting back, buying up huge swathes of land in both public and private sectors under a new model of conservation. He's the chief executive of Great Southern Land Conservancy and a former head of the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service, and was the inaugural boss of the Australian Wildlife Conservancy. Atticus, welcome to Changing Australia on Radio National Breakfast.
Hi, Mel. Thanks for having me.
How urgent are the challenges our environment is facing?
Oh, look, I don't think they've ever been more urgent. I mean, I was lucky enough to grow up in the bush, a bit south of a place called Wellington in the central west. And, you know, as a young kid, I guess I was borderline obsessed with endangered wildlife and national parks. And what I quickly came to realise was that even there where I was growing up, like much of inland Australia, it was a global epicentre for extinctions. So when you think about it in those terms, you know, few places in the world have lost as much in terms of wildlife and habitat as inland Australia. So yes, Australia is very important for biodiversity, but unfortunately we've also lost more than almost anywhere else in the world.
And so you've undertaken a professional life to try and tackle these challenges. At the Australian Wildlife Conservancy, you really pioneered an approach of integrating practical land management, of Indigenous partnerships, of science and philanthropy. How did that approach change the game?
Well, Australian Wildlife Conservancy was founded by this guy called Martin Copley, and it was really Tim Flannery who suggested to me I go and talk to Martin. And so we started off buying land for conservation, and we had some big wins. You know, we were able to buy properties like Kalamurina in central Australia that was, you know, 1.7 million acres. So that was at the time, and I think still is, the largest private acquisition of land for conservation in the world. So we could buy big chunks of land, and Australia's rare globally in terms of that opportunity. But then, you know, as time goes by, it becomes harder and more expensive to buy land. So you need to look at other strategies. And that's where we started to develop the partnerships with government. So we work with the National Park Service, or AWC worked with the National Park Service in New South Wales. We formed an alliance with Defence up in the Kimberley to manage one of their big training areas. And we worked with a range of sort of pastoral groups and Aboriginal groups around Australia. And it was just it was opening up new opportunities to expand the footprint for conservation in a way that worked with a whole range of stakeholders. And I think that was probably the key change.
Is that why land acquisition or partnerships of land management are so important? You can't get that concerted effort directed into conservation if you don't have a role in the management of the land?
I think when you just think about how much we've lost and then ask the question, what is the best thing we can do to both halt the loss of Australia's wildlife? And remember, you know, we have the worst mammal extinction rate in the world. We've got 2,000 plus threatened species. What are the things we need to do to stop and reverse that loss? And the best thing we can do is put areas into protected areas, whether that's national parks as part of the public estate, whether it's private protected areas, whether it's Indigenous protected areas. So first step, we need more land that is managed for conservation. And the second step is then making sure that land is really well managed, because it's not enough just to buy it. It's not enough to draw a line around a place and call it a national park. And look at the challenges when it comes to managing land. How do we deal with feral cats and other feral animals, weeds and so on? I mean, they're huge challenges, and they are challenges that have been building for 200 years. So, A, it's really urgent to try and turn around these losses, but B, you know, we've got a mountain to climb.
This is an approach that you have seen progress in both the private sector and through philanthropy, but also in the public sector from your time with the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service. Which do you think is more influential, or how can you be influential differently in the private versus the public sector?
Great question. They're both really important, and I don't think one is more important or more influential than the other. But you can employ different strategies. I think, you know, in the private or non-profit sector, you can probably be a little more nimble, move more rapidly, be a little bit more creative. But in the public sector, you often have an opportunity to do things at scale, and sometimes that can be backed up by regulation or legislation. So you've got different tools that you can deploy depending on whether you're in the private or the public sector. And, you know, probably the really big question is how we knit those two approaches together. It's really three approaches. It's the work on Aboriginal land, it's the work in the private sector, and it's the work in the public sector. And getting those three sectors, you know, working in a more integrated way is probably one of the keys to stopping and reversing this loss of our wildlife.
You're listening to Changing Australia on Radio National Breakfast. I'm Melissa Clark, and my guest today is Atticus Fleming, a leader in Australia's conservation efforts. Atticus, with those comments in mind, of course, I have to ask you about the federal government's deal that it struck with the Greens to reform national environment laws. What do you make of the position the government has ultimately landed on and the laws that were rushed through Parliament at the end of the year? Do you think the government has managed to get the right balance or the right focus with the deal that it struck?
Well, for context, I think the big questions for us, what do we do to turn around this loss of wildlife? One is get more protected areas. And I think the second is stop the destruction of habitat. So I look through the lens of what should these laws be doing to stop the destruction of habitat? I think it is a step forward that the exemption for forestry, for logging native forests has been removed. But the real test is in 18 months. In other words, that exemption is removed in 18 months. At that point, the federal government needs to decide whether it is going to just tick off on the existing state schemes, accredit them, or whether it is going to say, actually, no, native forest harvesting in its current form, or perhaps at all, should not occur. So the big test comes in 18 months. I don't think they've done enough on land clearing. There's a step forward by removing one of the exemptions, but it's a relatively minor exemption. So I think we need more. And David Pocock moved some amendments in the Senate which would have really addressed excessive land clearing, high-risk land clearing, really well. And unfortunately, they didn't get up. And I think the other big risk is the legislation has provided a lot of opportunity to hand things back to the states. And that may not occur, and let's hope it doesn't. Or if it does occur, it may occur within the right framework. But there's a concern there that too much will be handed back to the states, because the states, unfortunately, you know, the reason you have federal legislation is because the states over time have demonstrated they are unwilling or unable to properly regulate things like land clearing or native forest harvesting. And when the states don't do that properly, the feds must act.
I just want to take a bit of a broader step back when it comes to this public policy approach to trying to conserve nature. I mean, when we initially had the EPBC Act introduced, it was a regulatory approach to trying to help protect biodiversity. More recent years, we've seen a focus on market-based approaches, you know, trading systems for carbon credits, biodiversity credits on a nature positive market. What do you think the approach should be in the future? Is there a role for those market-based approaches, or do we ultimately need to be looking to regulation and legislation to make the difference we're trying to make?
Look, I think it's become a bit trendy to say that regulation is old school and we need to just focus on market-based approaches. I think that's wrong. I think you need a mix of the two. There will always be a really important role for a strong regulatory baseline. That's why we need strong laws around land clearing, for example. There is also a role for market-based approaches, but I think what is often overlooked is the need for those markets to, the rules around the market to be written in such a way that you are driving the behaviour that you really want. You can't just leave that up to the market. If you're going to have a market-based approach, you write the rules so that you are telling the market what they must deliver. And if they don't deliver, you know, nothing happens, but they don't get the rewards either.
With a lifetime of professional work in an area that can at times be controversial, you certainly have to deal with really divergent views amongst stakeholders. I remember once talking to a minister who had held health and environment portfolios and said health was easy, you just need money. In the environment, no one's ever happy no matter what you do. I don't know if you share that view, but I know you've seen up close the debates that have raged around culling of feral animals, you know, particularly feral horses, the reburial of Indigenous remains of Mungo Man and Mungo Lady, which split Indigenous communities. How do you manage the really emotional elements when you're trying to implement broad-scale change in conservation?
You know, it's great that there are a whole range of stakeholders who are really passionate and interested in this space. You know, that's great. It is really challenging to navigate it. I think the keys are, and say if you take the Kosciuszko wild horse example, you know, one of the keys is just to be really clear about what the objective is and then very consistent in terms of its delivery. And in that instance, it was, we need to remove feral horses because if we don't, the conservation values of Kosciuszko National Park, a globally significant park, will be destroyed. And obviously, we're also removing deer and pigs. But in that instance, you just needed to clearly state what had to happen and stick with it. And then, of course, be conscious of the fact that that was going to be problematic for some stakeholders, respect their views, but say, we're not going to move from that ambition. What we will do is deliver it in a way that is sensitive, in this case, to the welfare issues. And can I just say, you know, 8,000 horses removed, not a single adverse welfare incident in all of that, demonstrates the sort of passion, the commitment, the skill of the on-ground staff of National Parks and Wildlife down there at Kosciuszko, which was an amazing outcome. Mm. And so if you can be really clear about your objective, open about the objective, and then deliver it well, then you can normally navigate a way through.
Atticus Fleming, I really appreciate you talking to us for Changing Australia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Atticus Fleming is the Director and Chief Executive of Great Southern Land Conservancy.